Welcome to the Campbell Conversations. I'm Grant Reher. My guest this week covered labor and workplace issues for the New York Times for 19 years and has recently written a book about labor's ups and downs in America. Stephen Greenhouse is the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. He's also written The Big Squeeze: Tough Times for the American Worker. Stephen, welcome to the program.
Great to be here, Grant.
Well, thanks for making the time to join me. Let's start with the book itself, and then we'll get into some current issues that are related to some of the themes that the book deals with. But first of all, could you just give me a brief review of how labor and labor's influence helped to create the post-World War II economy in the United States, which we tend to regard as being so successful in terms of providing real improvements for most Americans?
Sure. Again, great to be here. So as we all know, during the 1930s was the Great Depression, where millions and millions of workers were laid off. 20-25% of the American workforce were laid off. People were in dire poverty. And people wanted to lift themselves, have better lives. And Franklin Delano Roosevelt agreed we have to help lift American workers. And one way to do that is give them a right to form a union. So there was a landmark law passed in 1935, the National Labor Relations Act, that gave American workers a right to unionize. The ball really got rolling in the late 1930s. Millions of workers joined unions. Then World War II came, and after World War II, millions more workers joined unions. And after World War II, there was a huge period of prosperity. The suburbs were built, the interstate highway system was built, and General Motors, Ford, General Electric, U.S. Steel, they were booming. And a lot of workers said, hey, we're still not doing very well. These companies are doing great and we're not. And the unions really mobilized the workers. There were these humongous strikes, lead stories in newspapers across the country at General Motors, at Ford, at U.S. Steel. And they won the unions won these amazing contracts that, gave them 20% raises over 5 years, gave them health insurance, gave them pensions, and really moved people up from kind of struggling to moderate working class to really form a true middle class. And it was these union contracts, first at General Motors and U.S. Steel and Ford, that kind of spread across the country. And those contracts really were the secret to the union power in these contracts are really the secret to building the middle class and enabled people for the first time to own their own houses and to be able to buy cars. So the 1950s, 60s, 70s were really a period of record prosperity in the United States, partly because companies are doing so well, and that's great. We want companies to succeed. And second, because the power of unions helped ensure that workers got a fair deal, got to share in the company's profits and prosperity.
So you brought your story up to the 70s, and then something went wrong for labor, I think, in the 1970s and the 1980s. And at the beginning of your book, you write that, and I'm quoting you here, "The decline of unions and of worker bargaining power in general has taken a toll on our nation. It has contributed to many of the country's major problems: increased income inequality, wage stagnation, declining mobility, the high number of low-wage jobs, and the skewing of our politics in favor of corporations and wealthy campaign donors." I'm just wondering if you could say a little bit more about that decline in labor power, and particularly what's cause and what's effect, because they seem to be interrelated in terms of labor's relative position of strength and those broader national problems that you elucidated there.
Sure. Grant, the major reason I wrote the book is I feel that many Americans, especially young Americans, don't appreciate, what unions do and how they really, built a fair America and built the middle class. And secondly, a lot of Americans don't appreciate how the decline of unions and of worker power have really hurt Americans in many, many ways. And in the book, I explain that kind of 1980 was a critical point where unions had gotten steadily stronger basically from the late 1930s into the 1960s and 1970s. And 1980, with the rise of globalization, increased foreign competition, this horrible recession in 1980-81 where, tons of factories closed, causing, lots of union members to lose their jobs, and the election of Ronald Reagan, who's you know, Ronald Reagan used to be president of the union, the Screen Actors Guild, but he, along with Donald Trump, led the two most anti-union presidencies in modern American history. And, you know, there was the air traffic controller strike, which is an illegal strike, and it, to my mind, not a very wise strike. And President Reagan fired 11,000 air traffic controllers, and that really kind of sent a signal to corporations across the country that it's fine to get tougher with unions. Anyway, so unions grew weaker. At the same time, American companies felt huge pressure from globalization. And a lot of American companies moved jobs to China and India and Sri Lanka and Mexico and Honduras and the Dominican Republic. So together, the decline of unions with this intense pressure from foreign competition really helped push down wages and cause companies to close factories and reduce benefits. And you know, I submit in the book that if unions were stronger, as strong as they were in the 1950s and 60s, many companies would not have been so quick to move factories because unions would have helped prevent that. Look at Germany. Germany has one of the strongest union movements in the world. Germany also has this exceptional thing called co-determination, where workers elect members to corporate boards. And we haven't seen nearly as much outsourcing in Germany, which has far higher wages than we do in the United States. Whereas in the United States, where workers don't have much say in companies, there's been far more outsourcing. And I think that's one of the main reasons American workers have been so unhappy. Why so many blue-collar workers voted for Donald Trump? Because they felt the system wasn't delivering to them. And I would submit it wasn't the Democrats' fault that the system isn't delivering to them. It wasn't Barack Obama's fault. It was that, you know, the system, as they argue at length in the book, the system is skewed against workers. They have very little voice at work. We have the weakest union movement, unfortunately, of any industrial country. In the United States, just 12% of workers gain the benefits of union contracts. In France, 98% of workers do. In Germany, 60% of workers do. So there's something, I submit, really broken in the United States, that, you know, corporate profits, you know, keep going through the roof while wages for workers stagnate decade after decade.
I'm Grant Reher. You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, and I'm speaking with former New York Times reporter Stephen Greenhouse. He's the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. There's something else that you write about that concerns the sense of solidarity among different workers during this time period. And you capture it through your mother's observation about this. And you quote her as saying, "When I was growing up, people used to say, 'Look at the good wages and benefits the people in a union have. I want to join a union.' Now people say, 'Look at the good wages and benefits that unions have. They're getting more than what I get. That's not fair. Let's take away some of what they have.'" So that's another problem that you didn't mention, but I'm just wondering, how can that sense of solidarity that your mother was talking about return? Is there a path forward there?
I think, you know, and we're really seeing that this during the pandemic, Grant. You know, there has been increased solidarity among workers and between workers and the general public. You know, the retail workers, you know, in Trader Joe's or in Kroger's, you know, who, you know, the companies are slow to give them masks or slow to create plexiglass, put up plexiglass partitions to protect the cashiers. You know, they felt this solidarity that, you know, we're not being treated right. We're not being protected enough. And a lot of the public agreed with them. So, you know, on a rudimentary level, we're seeing more solidarity. Take the teacher strikes. And in my book, I have a chapter and a half about the teacher strikes in 2018, first in West Virginia, then in Oklahoma, then in Arizona, then Los Angeles, Chicago. And those were real instances where labor very consciously sought to build solidarity with the community, where the teachers saw that, you know, these Republican-led legislatures in West Virginia, Oklahoma, Arizona kept cutting taxes on the rich and on corporations and on fracking. And as a result, there was very little money left in state treasuries, and the teachers are getting screwed, school budgets are getting screwed. The teacher said, things are really out of whack. You know, teacher-student ratios are getting worse and worse. We don't have enough money for new books. Parents are getting screwed. Kids are getting screwed. And we, the teachers, are going to stand up. And we want you, the community, to support us. And one of the amazing things, you know, I have this photo of this, the day the teachers went on strike in Arizona. There were like 75,000 people, not just teachers, but parents and kids and, you know, teenagers, you know, protesting with the teachers. Same thing in the Los Angeles teacher strike. When the Los Angeles teachers went on strike, their main thing wasn't to get a higher raise. It was to get more librarians in the schools and more guidance counselors in the schools and more green space for the kids who have very little green space and get better classroom sizes, you know, teacher-student ratios. And they said, we're fighting not so much for us, we're fighting for the community. I think we're really seeing increased solidarity. You know, one index of that, Grant, is, you know, there's an annual Gallup poll of how Americans feel about unions, and the approval rate of unions is at the highest level it's been in 50 years. And I think people realize that unions are fighting to help the average American. Certainly, as I explain in the book, there are many problems with unions. There's been too much corruption over the years, but there's much less corruption than there used to be. 50 years ago, there was too much discrimination against women, against African-American workers. 100 years ago, there was way too much discrimination against Asian workers, Chinese workers. But unions have really improved. There's less corruption. You know, there's much more welcoming of all Americans, whatever their color, whatever their sex, whatever their gender, whatever their nationality. And, you know, you look at what's happening in some of these Amazon warehouses now. You know, there'll be workers from East Africa and you know, Caucasian workers. Then they're all fighting together to improve things. So I think we are, you know, we are seeing greater solidarity, not as much as in the 1930s and 40s and 50s.
So another aspect that you identify as a hopeful sign is the push for a $15 minimum wage. And President Biden is currently pushing for a raise in the minimum wage to $15. And there have been, and you talk about this, victories for workers in different states, including here in New York State on that front. How important is that change? And what do you think the prospects are at the national level for getting a $15 minimum wage?
So in my book, Grant, I devote a full chapter to the fight for 15. And I profile a fast food worker in Kansas City who worked at both Burger King and Pizza Hut. And he'd leave home at 6 a.m. to go to his Burger King job. And then he'd work 8 hours there and go to his Pizza Hut job. And he wouldn't get home until after midnight. And as a result, he, you know, left home before his three daughters woke up. He, you know, returned home after they'd gone to sleep. You know, he wouldn't see his daughters 5 days in a row. And at one point, his fiance, who was a home care worker, hurt her back very much, and she couldn't work for a few weeks. And they became homeless, even though he worked 2 full-time jobs. Mm-hmm. So, just to make the point that, you know, something has broken our economy. I used to be a reporter in Europe, and Europeans often would say, we have, America has a low road economy where a lot of people have mixed jobs that really don't pay enough. So the fight for 15 began in 2012. You know, when I was at the New York Times, I was the very first reporter to write about this. And the first day, there were 200 workers walked out at 20 restaurants in New York. And I think a lot of us thought, big deal, they're crazy, they're asking for $15. This isn't going to go anywhere. And I remember telling some of the organizers, you know, this is a nice pipe dream, but we'll see how far it goes. And now, you know, it's gone very far. You know, 9 states have laws for $15. Even Florida, very conservative Florida, which backed Donald Trump, voted 61% to 39% to adopt a $15 minimum wage. And now President Biden is pushing a $15 minimum wage. I did a big story for the Guardian newspaper 2 days ago where I interviewed Bernie Sanders, and he's pushing very hard for a $15 minimum wage. He thinks he's a strategy to get it enacted despite the possibility of a filibuster. And it really could pass this year. Certainly, you know, the House voted for a $15 minimum wage last year, and Mitch McConnell blocked it. But now with the Democrats in control, if they could figure out a way to approve it with, you know, despite the filibuster, I think it could really be enacted. And that will come down whether it's defined where they can be passed under budget reconciliation. But I mean, the amazing thing, and I point this out in the book, is that this, you know, the whole Fight for 15 movement, and I explain how the service employees unions and some other folks founded this effort, they were very dismayed that America had in many ways become a low wage economy. And the fact that so many workers were stuck on the bottom was hardly discussed. And they wanted to change the conversation. They wanted lawmakers and policymakers and learned professors like you to be discussing, you know, the whole problem of low wage America. And the Fight for 15 has been a huge success in that respect.
You're listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media. I'm Grant Reher, and I'm talking with Stephen Greenhouse. He's the author of Beaten Down, Worked Up: The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. So one of the things that President Trump touted in his reelection campaign was this notion that real wages for workers, this is prior to the pandemic, were finally going up, and they were going up for different historically disadvantaged groups. Is that something that should be rightfully part of the Trump record?
Yes. I, you know, have written articles about the 20 or 40 or 50 different ways that Donald Trump, you know, acted against the interest of workers and acted to weaken unions and didn't do enough to protect worker safety. But it's true that in the final year or two of his tenure, wages did go up. The question is, who gets credit for that? You know, when Barack Obama became president, there was this horrible recession, and unemployment rose to 10% early on Obama's watch. But when Obama's president, the jobless rate fell from 10% to 4.7%, a drop of 5.3 percentage points. I often joke that Trump became president when the economy was on third base, and Trump said, "Hey, everyone, I hit a triple." And with Trump, the unemployment rate fell very nicely down to 3.5% from 4.7% under Obama. So it fell somewhat more. And when the labor market has been so tight, then wages finally increase. Now you could say Trump caused some of that. You can say Obama caused some of that. I think, you know, there are three ways in my mind that Trump really goosed the economy. Was by having the deficit go sky high. Two, by reducing all these regulations to protect workers and to protect the environment, and that encouraged business to, hire more people, increase jobs. And three, Trump spent $1.5 gazillion on the Pentagon. So, in ways, he goosed the economy. But one might argue, in none of those ways were those truly healthy ways to boost the economy. He promised. One of the ways he got elected was he promised, you know, blue-collar Americans he was going to spend $1 trillion on infrastructure to improve roads and bridges and highways and tunnels and create hundreds of thousands of middle-class jobs. He did zilch on infrastructure. He did zilch on raising the minimum wage. The minimum wage hasn't been increased in 11 years, the longest time in American history, without an increase. Biden, I think, is very serious about enacting an infrastructure plan. He's very serious that his, you know, climate change policies will create jobs, not destroy jobs. And Biden is really, and he has a better, tougher Buy America program than Trump. And I think, you know, the Trump administration, I submit, was very pro-corporate. It did not want to step on corporations' toes. It did not want to pressure them in any way to raise wages. I think Biden sees how wages have really been stagnant generally for the past 30, 40 years. There has been, you know, one or two good years. And he says, we've got to do far more to raise workers' wages. And he's really out there trying to do that.
You mentioned earlier in our conversation about the unions having a seat at the management table in Germany, that model existed there. And one of the things that has been a deep challenge for our political system in this country is the political polarization between the two parties. So it would seem to me there might be some perhaps tangential connections between that model and the problem that we have politically here in this country. And in your book, you do tell some stories about labor and management being able to work together across the divide, across the aisle, so to speak, both to make the companies more efficient and to help raise wages. Do you think there are any lessons for our political system that can be found in this dynamic between labor and management?
Good question, Grant. So when you look at public opinion polls, Americans by 2 to 1, 67% to 33% favor a $15 minimum wage. Can you get any Republicans in the House or Senate to vote for $15 minimum wage? No, because they're really beholden to their corporate donors and the Koch brothers or the Koch brothers network, and kind of are ignoring the will of the American people. Another poll shows by 2 to 1 margins, American support allowing workers to elect members to corporate boards as exists in Germany. And I think, Americans deep down, American workers, American, typical Americans, American middle class feel deep down something is broken, that they don't have enough voice on the job, that corporations are too quick to take advantage. And that's why we see these polls where they say, workers, workers need a stronger voice on safety on a job. Workers should be able to elect people to corporate boards. And the problem is that, Republican lawmakers, the Republican Party sees unions as the enemy because, unions often favor Democrats because Republicans are so anti-union and so pro-business. And so in ways I submit, Republican leaders, the Wall Street Journal, Rush Limbaugh, Fox News, they all, propagate this anti-union stuff. I think that helps move some typical Americans against unions. But I think deep down, as this Gallup poll shows with, 67% approval of unions, Americans realize that unions help them. Even a lot of conservative Americans now realize that, 50 years ago, unions helped lift their grandparents and their great-grandparents and help, move them into the middle class and out of poverty. So there's a sense, I think Biden, Scranton Joe is really trying to tap into this. I think he could well prove to be the most pro-union president since Franklin Roosevelt. He's really, yesterday when he was talked about climate jobs, and yes, people in West Virginia and Pennsylvania and Kentucky are worried that if we use less coal, that will, destroy many coal jobs. But Biden explains, whatever I do on the climate, I will try to pair it with job creation and union jobs and middle class jobs. And so I think he gets it much more than Obama did, much more than Trump did, much more than either of the Bushes did, that job creation is essential, and that if we, and as we move towards a cleaner, greener economy to fight global warming, that will create jobs. When you create, 1.5 million, electric plug, charging stations across the nation, that's going to create a lot of jobs. And he gets that. Biden gets that.
You mentioned this earlier in our conversation, but the pandemic, in your thinking, obviously has had some challenges for labor, but it's opened up some new opportunities too for labor. Could you just briefly talk a little bit about the second, the new opportunities?
Sure. Retail workers complained that they weren't given masks, that they risked their lives on the job, and they weren't given hazard pay. I think even McDonald's workers who complained that they weren't given masks or gloves or hand sanitizer. Amazon workers complained that, they're squeezed too much together, often less than 6 feet apart. So a lot of workers are really upset that their employers haven't done enough to protect them and haven't paid them anything extra, even though these essential workers, go to work, face real dangers. So there's been this greater solidarity and a greater movement to unionize. We've seen that at some retail stores. We've seen that at, Instacart delivery people. And now we're seeing that at Amazon. There's this landmark unionization drive at by 5,800 workers for 5,800 workers at an Amazon warehouse in Alabama. So, I think as a result of all this worker dismay, disgruntlement, this feeling that corporations were not doing enough to look out for them, we are seeing more worker interest in unions, more worker militancy even.
So just a couple minutes left, and I wanted to ask you about a more subtle kind of potential effect that might hurt labor strength going forward, and it's this. There's been a tectonic shift in recent decades in retirement benefits for workers from defined benefit plans to defined contribution plans, 401k plans, and so on. And those are often heavily invested in the stock market. And I'm wondering whether that might change the support among many in the middle class and the upper middle class who now have, for them, considerable personal investments in corporations through these mechanisms, so that they're going to be thinking sort of more along the lines of the corporate side? They might side more with corporate interests and less with workers. Does that seem like it might be a problem to you?
Not so much to me, Grant. Yeah, so what, you know, polls show 50% of Americans have no retirement savings, period. I was just reading an article in the New York Times today. The top 5% of Americans own 71% of all stocks. The bottom 90% own just 16% of stocks. And I think that the folks in the middle, you know, own a little stock, you know, and I think it said that as a result of the boom in the stock market over the last year or two, it just increased their wealth by $2,000, big deal, whereas for people at the top, it meant $170,000. So I think a lot of workers feel it's much more important to try to get gains at work and protect their jobs at work and create more of a voice at work. And it's not as if they own tons of stock in their own corporation, and if they get better wages, it's going to hurt the stock performance at their company. They're more concerned about the broader stock market. So if they get a nice, 8% raise over 2 years at their company, that's not going to hurt the broader stock market. And I think, generally what I've been seeing is that over the past year or two, there's a sense during the pandemic, a lot of workers feel the system hasn't worked for them. Not nearly as enough has been done to protect them at work, that far too few employers listen to their, in the beginning of the pandemic, far too few employers really listened to their workers about what was needed. And whether we're talking about teachers or Amazon workers or Uber drivers. And I think a lot of workers are really angry and jazzed up. But, American corporations are very sophisticated in knowing how to suppress worker voice. We've seen Google fire activists. We've seen Amazon fire activists. And so that, corporate America is really trying to suppress this increased efforts by workers to have a greater voice and have more unions on the job.
Well, we'll have to leave it there. That was Stephen Greenhouse. And again, his book is titled Beaten Down, Worked Up, The Past, Present, and Future of American Labor. It's extremely readable. I recommend it highly. Stephen, thanks so much for talking with me, and I want to wish good health to you and your family.
Thanks. It was great talking with you, Grant, and keep well and keep up the good work.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Campbell Conversations on WRVO Public Media, conversations in the public interest.
The Campbell Conversations, conversations in the public interest, was hosted and produced by Grant Reher, engineered by Tom Fazio, and edited by Mark Levonier. The Campbell Conversations is a joint production of the Campbell Public Affairs Institute at Syracuse University and WRVO Public Media. To learn more about the program or to hear previous interviews, visit wrvo.org/Campbell Conversations.